Chapter 40. Nobody's weakness, the time being come for the renewal of his acquaintance with the Meagles family, Clennam, pursuant to contract made between himself and Mr. Meagles within the precincts of Bleeding Heart Yard, turned his face on a certain Saturday towards Twickenham, where Mr. Meagles had a cottage residence of his own. The weather being fine and dry, and an English road abounding in interest for him who had been so long away, he sent his valise on by the coach, and set out to walk. A walk was in itself a new enjoyment to him, and one that had rarely diversified his life afar off. He went by Fulham and Putney, for the pleasure of strolling over the heath. It was bright and shining there, and when he found himself so far on his road to Twickenham, he found himself a long way on his road to a number of airier and less substantial destinations. They had risen before him fast, in the healthful exercise and the pleasant road. It is not easy to walk alone in the country without musing upon something. And he had plenty of unsettled subjects to meditate upon, though he had been walking to the Land's End. First, there was the subject seldom absent from his mind, the question, what he was to do henceforth in life, to what occupation he should devote himself, and in what direction he had best seek it. He was far from rich, and every day of indecision and inaction made his inheritance a source of greater anxiety to him. As often as he began to consider how to increase this inheritance, or to lay it by, so often his misgiving, that there was someone with an unsatisfied claim upon his justice, returned, and that alone was a subject to outlast the longest walk. Again, there was the subject of his relations with his mother, which were now upon an equable, and peaceful but never confidential footing, and whom he saw several times a week. Little Dorrit was a leading, and a constant subject. For the circumstances of his life, united to those of her own story, presented the little creature to him as the only person between whom and himself there were ties of innocent reliance on one hand, and affectionate protection on the other, ties of compassion, respect, unselfish interest, gratitude, and pity. Thinking of her, and of the possibility of her father's release from prison by the unbarring hand of death, the only change of circumstance he could foresee that might enable him to be such a friend to her as he wished to be, by altering her whole manner of life, smoothing her rough road, and giving her a home, he regarded her, in that perspective, as his adopted daughter, his poor child of the Marshalsea hushed to rest. If there were a last subject in his thoughts, and it lay towards Twickenham, its form was so indefinite, that it was little more than the pervading atmosphere in which these other subjects floated before him. He had crossed the heath, and was leaving it behind when he gained upon a figure which had been in advance of him for some time, and which, as he gained upon it, he thought he knew. He derived this impression from something in the turn of the head, and in the figure's action of consideration, as it went on at a sufficiently sturdy walk. But when the man, for it was a man's figure, pushed his hat up at the back of his head, and stopped to consider some object before him, he knew it to be Daniel Doyce. "How do you do, Mr. Doyce?" said Clennam, overtaking him. "I am glad to see you again, and in a healthier place than the Circumlocution Office. Mr. Meagles' friend!" exclaimed that public criminal, coming out of some mental combinations he had been making, and offering his hand. "I am glad to see you, sir. Will you excuse me if I forget your name?" "Readily. It's not a celebrated name. It's not Barnacle." "No, said Daniel, laughing. "And now I know what it is. It's Clennam. How do you do, Mr. Clennam?" "I have some hope," said Arthur, as they walked on together, "that we may be going to the same place, Mr. Doyce."
"Meaning Twickenham?"
returned Daniel. "I am glad to hear it." They were soon quite intimate, and lightened the way with a variety of conversation.
The ingenious culprit was a man of great modesty and good sense, and, though a plain man, had been too much accustomed to combine what was original and daring in conception with what was patient and minute in execution, to be by any means an ordinary man. It was at first difficult to lead him to speak about himself, and he put off Arthur's advances in that direction by admitting slightly, oh yes, he had done this, and he had done that, and such a thing was of his making, and such another thing was his discovery, but it was his trade, you see, his trade. Until, as he gradually became assured that his companion had a real interest in his account of himself, he frankly yielded to it. Then it appeared that he was the son of a North Country blacksmith, and had originally been apprenticed by his widowed mother to a lockmaker, that he had struck out a few little things at the lockmaker's, which had led to his being released from his indentures with a present, which present had enabled him to gratify his ardent wish to bind himself to a working engineer, under whom he had labored hard, learned hard, and lived hard 7 years. His time being out, he had worked in the shop at weekly wages 7 or 8 years more, and had then betakened himself to the banks of the Clyde, where he had studied, and filed, and hammered, and improved his knowledge, theoretical and practical, for 6 or 7 years more. There he had had an offer to go to Lyons, which he had accepted, and from Lyons, had been engaged to go to Germany, and in Germany had had an offer to go to St. Petersburg, and there had done very well indeed, never better. However, he had naturally felt a preference for his own country, and a wish to gain distinction there, and to do whatever service he could do there rather than elsewhere. And so he had come home. And so at home he had established himself in business, and had invented and executed, and worked his way on, until, after a dozen years of constant suit and service, he had been enrolled in the great British Legion of Honor, the Legion of the Rebuffed of the Circumlocution Office, and had been decorated with the great British Order of Merit, the Order of the Disorder of the Barnacles and Stiltstockings. It is much to be regretted, said Clennam, that you ever turned your thoughts that way, Mr. Doyce. True, sir, true to a certain extent. But what is a man to do? If he has the misfortune to strike out something serviceable to the nation, he must follow where it leads him. Hadn't he better let it go? Said Clennam. He can't do it, said Doyce, shaking his head with a thoughtful smile. It's not put into his head to be buried. It's put into his head to be made useful. You hold your life on the condition that to the last you shall struggle hard for it. Every man holds a discovery on the same terms. That is to say, said Arthur, with a growing admiration of his quiet companion, you are not finally discouraged even now? I have no right to be, if I am, returned the other. The thing is as true as it ever was. When they had walked a little way in silence, Clennam, at once to change the direct point of their conversation, and not to change it too abruptly, asked Mr. Doyce if he had any partner in his business to relieve him of a portion of its anxieties. No, he returned, not at present. I had when I first entered on it, and a good man he was. But he has been dead some years. And as I could not easily take to the notion of another when I lost him, I bought his share for myself, and have gone on by myself ever since. And here's another thing, he said, stopping for a moment with a good-humored laugh in his eyes, and laying his closed right hand, with its peculiar suppleness of thumb, on Clennam's arm, no inventor can be a man of business, you know. No? Said Clennam. Why, so the men of business say, he answered, resuming the walk and laughing outright. I don't know why we unfortunate creatures should be supposed to want common sense, but it is generally taken for granted that we do. Even the best friend I have in the world, our excellent friend over yonder, apostrophe said Doyce, nodding towards Twickenham, extends a sort of protection to me, don't you know, as a man not quite able to take care of himself? Apostrophe apostrophe Arthur Clennam could not help joining in the good-humored laugh, for he recognized the truth of the description. So I find that I must have a partner who is a man of business, and not guilty of any inventions, apostrophe said Daniel Doyce, taking off his hat, to pass his hand over his forehead, if it's only in deference to the current opinion, and to uphold the credit of the works. I don't think you'll find that I have been very remiss, or confused in my way of conducting them, but that's for him to say whoever he is, not for me. Apostrophe you have not chosen him yet, then? Apostrophe apostrophe no, sir, no. I have only just come to a decision to take one. The fact is, there's more to do than there used to be, and the works are enough for me as I grow older. What with the books and correspondence, and foreign journeys for which a principal is necessary, I can't do all. I am going to talk over the best way of negotiating the matter, if I find a spare half hour between this and Monday morning, with my nurse and protector, apostrophe said Doyce, with laughing eyes again. He is a sagacious man in business, and has had a good apprenticeship to it. Apostrophe, after this, they conversed on different subjects until they arrived at their journey's end. A composed and unobtrusive self-sustainment was noticeable in Daniel Doyce, a calm knowledge that what was true must remain true, in spite of all the barnacles in the family ocean, and would be just the truth, and neither more nor less when, even that sea had run dry which had a kind of greatness in it, though not of the official quality. As he knew the house well, he conducted Arthur to it by the way that showed it to the best advantage. It was a charming place, none the worse for being a little eccentric, on the road by the river, and just what the residence of the Meagles family ought to be. It stood in a garden, no doubt as fresh and beautiful in the May of the year as Pet now was in the May of her life, and it was defended by a goodly show of handsome trees and spreading evergreens, as Pet was by Mr. and Mrs. Meagles. It was made out of an old brick house, of which a part had been altogether pulled down, and another part had been changed into the present cottage. So there was a hale elderly portion, to represent Mr. and Mrs. Meagles, and a young picturesque, very pretty portion to represent Pet. There was even the later addition of a conservatory sheltering itself against it, uncertain of hue in its deep stained glass, and in its more transparent portions flashing to the sun's rays, now like fire and now like harmless water drops, which might have stood for Tattycoram. Within view was the peaceful river and the ferry boat, to moralize to all the inmates saying, young or old, passionate or tranquil, chafing or content, you, thus runs the current always. Let the heart swell into what discord it will, thus plays the rippling water on the prow of the ferry boat ever the same tune. Year after year, so much allowance for the drifting of the boat, so many miles an hour the flowing of the stream, here the rushes, there the lilies, nothing uncertain or unquiet, upon this road, that steadily runs away. While you, upon your flowing road of time, are so capricious and distracted. The bell at the gate had scarcely sounded when Mr. Meagles came out to receive them. Mr. Meagles had scarcely come out when Mrs. Meagles came out. Mrs. Meagles had scarcely come out when Pet came out. Pet scarcely had come out when Tattycoram came out. Never had visitors a more hospitable reception. Here we are, you see, apostrophe said Mr. Meagles, boxed up, Mr. Clennam, within our own home limits, as if we were never going to expand, that is, travel again. Not like Marseille, eh? No allonging and marchonging here. Apostrophe apostrophe, a different kind of beauty, indeed. Apostrophe apostrophe said Clennam, looking about him. But, Lord bless me. Apostrophe apostrophe cried Mr. Meagles, rubbing his hands with a relish, it was an uncommonly pleasant thing being in quarantine, wasn't it? Do you know, I have often wished myself back again? We were a capital party. Apostrophe, this was Mr. Meagles' invariable habit. Always to object to everything, while he was traveling, and always to want to get back to it, when he was not traveling. If it was summertime, apostrophe said Mr. Meagles, which I wish it was on your account, and in order that you might see the place at its best, you would hardly be able to hear yourself speak for birds. Being practical people, we never allow anybody to scare the birds, and the birds, being practical people too, come about us in myriads. We are delighted to see you, Clennam. If you'll allow me, I shall drop the mister, I heartily assure you, we are delighted. Apostrophe, I have not had so pleasant a greeting, apostrophe said Clennam. Then he recalled what little Dorrit had said to him in his own room, and faithfully added, except once, since we last walked to and fro, looking down at the Mediterranean. Apostrophe, ah. Apostrophe, apostrophe, returned Mr. Meagles. Something like a lookout, that wasn't it? I don't want a military government, but I shouldn't mind a little allonging and marshonging, just a dash of it in this neighborhood sometimes. It's devilish still. Apostrophe, bestowing this eulogium on the retired character of his retreat with a dubious shake of the head, Mr. Meagles led the way into the house. It was just large enough, and no more. Was as pretty within as it was without, and was perfectly well arranged and comfortable. Some traces of the migratory habits of the family were to be observed in the covered frames and furniture, and wrapped up hangings, but it was easy to see that it was one of Mr. Meagles' whims to have the cottage always kept, in their absence, as if they were always coming back the day after tomorrow. Of articles collected on his various expeditions, there was such a vast miscellany that it was like the dwelling of an amiable corsair. There were antiquities from central Italy, made by the best modern houses in that department of industry. Bits of mummy from Egypt and perhaps Birmingham, model gondolas from Venice, model villages from Switzerland. Morsels of tessellated pavement from Herculaneum and Pompeii, like petrified minced veal, ashes out of tombs, and lava out of Vesuvius, Spanish fans, Spezian straw hats, Moorish slippers, Tuscan hairpins, Carrara sculpture, Trastavarini scarves, Genoese velvets and filigree, Neapolitan coral, Roman cameos, Geneva jewelry, Arab lanterns, rosaries blessed all round by the Pope himself, and an infinite variety of lumber. There were views, like and unlike, of a multitude of places, and there was one little picture room devoted to a few of the regular sticky old saints, with sinews like whipcord, hair like Neptune's, wrinkles like tattooing, and such coats of varnish, that every holy personage served for a flytrap, and became what is now called in the vulgar tongue a catch-em-alive-o. Of these pictorial acquisitions Mr. Meagles spoke in the usual manner. He was no judge, he said, except of what pleased himself. He had picked them up, dirt cheap, and people had considered them rather fine. One man, who at any rate ought to know something of the subject, had declared that sage, reading a specially oily old gentleman in a blanket, with a swan's down tippet for a beard, and a web of cracks all over him like rich pie crust, to be a fine Guercino. As for Sebastian del Piombo there, you would judge for yourself. If it were not his later manner, the question was, who was it? Titian, that might or might not be, perhaps he had only touched it. Daniel Doyce said perhaps he hadn't touched it, but Mr. Meagles rather declined to overhear the remark. When he had shown all his spoils, Mr. Meagles took them into his own snug room overlooking the lawn, which was fitted up in part like a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.